Welcome to Earth Eats. I'm Annie Corrigan.
They would have carried these baskets full of food to important family gatherings when they went. So these would have been just an ever-present, constant part of everyday life.
John Kay of Traditional Arts Indiana has a personal connection to the Oak Rod baskets made in Brown County in the early 20th century. He tells us about the people who made them and why the tradition faded away. Harvest tells us how farm scientists are preparing for next week's solar eclipse, and zucchini recipes. Our news team is taking the week off, so we're jumping right into a conversation with soil scientist Laura Lennick. Our changing climate presents a unique challenge for our food system, and she wants to help farmers and ranchers deal with the risks. She's a small farmer herself and a longtime sustainable agriculture researcher. Harvest Public Media's Luke Runyon spoke to Lennick about her book, Resilient Agriculture.
What is resilient agriculture?
I think I came to the idea of resilience from a fairly critical place, in that I thought it was maybe some new idea that was really no difference. It was just another word for sustainability. And what I have learned is that it is actually deeply and completely different from sustainability. Sustainability is a 20th century idea. It assumes that we will have stable conditions, that we can predict economic conditions, climate conditions, social conditions. Resilience assumes instability. It assumes that we can't predict conditions. It assumes that we will be surprised. And it assumes continuous change. These are all characteristics of, I'd say, the 21st century in general, but specifically the characteristics of how climate change is changing agriculture and food systems.
You have a few case studies in your newest book of farmers who've adopted some of these more innovative practices. One of them is Steve Ela of Ela Family Farms on Colorado's Western Slope. And that one really stuck out to me. What is Steve's story?
He's very focused on soil quality, improving soil quality, which provides a great buffer to more variable weather and extremes, particularly precipitation. And he is managing a very diverse operation. And that diversity has increased over time as variable weather has increased. And finally, he is focused on high-value marketing. So these three practices together, attention to soil quality, a high value placed on soil quality, diversified production, and diversified and high-value marketing are all resilient agriculture practices.
Say I'm a person who cares about this idea, who wants to support the idea of resilient farming. How am I supposed to know which farms and potentially even which companies to support?
I think that anyone that can afford to do it, to spend at least some of their food dollar supporting local and regional production and directly buying directly from producers who have diversified production systems. And so that means you'll need to get to know these farmers a little bit and ranches a little bit, and understand a little bit of the practices that they're using. A great place to get started at this is one of the many farmers markets that seem to be all along the Front Range. You have a very vibrant local and regional food system in Colorado. So that would be a first step. And there you're directly supporting farmers who are managing for high soil quality, diversified production, and then they are selling into these diversified markets. So we don't really have any label, and I think labels can get problematic anyway, and often can be more confusing than helpful. But there is no resilient agriculture label that can help a shopper right now make a choice among different products.
So it requires a little bit of the consumer.
I think it does require a little bit of the consumer, but I think climate change is going to require that we all change some of our behaviors and become a little more aware of not just the kind of food you're eating, but also the kind of the way that you're in your own life using resources, particularly those that are being increasingly threatened or challenged by climate changes.
That was Laura Lennox speaking with Harvest Public Media's Luke Runyon about her new book, Resilient Agriculture. We started thinking about zucchini last week with Dan Williamson's zucchini hash recipe. Then one of our shoppers at the Linton Farmers Market took home 4 summer squash. Today, we're just embracing the zucchini because there's a lot of it right now. Daniel Orr will cook up 2 recipes in a bit. But first, I revisited a conversation we had on WFIU's Noon Edition back in 2013. I was joined by Marcia Veldman of the Bloomington Community Farmers Market and Stephanie Solomon, a mother Hubbard's Cupboard. Lori Heber of Terra Foods says she had an abundance of one particular veggie.
Lots of zucchini. We've been blessed with amazing zucchini. So it's funny about zucchini. When you're overrun with it, you're overrun with it, and you're trying to find ways to deal with it and to give it away and to preserve it. But then when it's gone, you immediately want some more. So it's a challenge. I've been blanching and freezing zucchini in all different forms and manners so that it's ready to go for soups and stews come winter.
I've got a chocolate zucchini cake recipe here that I know I swear by. I'm making this all the time because I have so many zucchinis. You can also pickle them if you don't have cucumbers. You can pickle zucchinis. Mm-hmm. Other suggestions you guys have?
So on the days that we've gotten a lot of zucchini and summer squash coming through Mother Hubbard's Cupboard, the food pantry, we've been making fritters in our new kitchen and then having folks taste them in the pantry. And I personally love it because it makes the whole building smell fantastic, and it's pretty simple. She does a simple pan fry and a few spices. There would be an opportunity to use whatever herbs that you have in your garden growing right now. But yeah, it's one of the things I like about it, and we try to do this at Mother Hubbard's, is the simplicity of it. We try to do recipes that require few ingredients. So if folks don't have many ingredients at home besides what they're getting from the pantry, it's still possible to go home and try that recipe.
Let's talk a little bit about freezing. Marcia, you and I were talking about this before the show started. Can you freeze anything?
You can freeze a lot, that's for sure. Yeah, I have a chest freezer, and I find it's just the easiest way to put up produce. I used to always blanch tomatoes and skin them before sticking them in the freezer, and now I just wash and core them and leave the skin on. I do have a vacuum packer, which really helps to hold the moisture in and prevent some freezer burn. But yeah, I'll put up 50 gallons of tomatoes in the freezer and freeze lots of fruits, berries. I freeze basil too in ice cube trays. So just put the basil in a food processor with some water, put it in ice cube trays, add a little more water so it's topped off, and then you have cubes that you can pop into soups and sauces and that sort of thing. And it's a real nice, easy way to hang on to the basil, that summer flavor in the wintertime.
That was Marcia Veldman at the Bloomington Community Farmers Market, along with Stephanie Solomon of Mother Hubbard's Cupboard and Lori Heber of Terra Foods. The trick with basil, by the way, I've done that, and I've turned one of my ice cube trays into a basil tray, and it's the best. But back to zucchini, when Chef Daniel Orr isn't cooking, he's gardening.
It's been great. Everything is still going. You know, usually your beans and your tomatoes and your okra and everything kind of die out, but everything's still going strong. I'm still getting squash blossoms, so it's been a fun year in the garden.
How's zucchini been?
Zucchini has been overwhelming, as it tends to be. You know, you're so excited when those first few start coming on, and they're, you know, you pick them when they're nice and small and everything, and they're delicious, and then all of a sudden you find that gigantic one that's been hiding under a zucchini leaf, and then all hell breaks loose, and you're leaving them on people's doorsteps and all kinds of stuff.
Ah, yes, the great late summer zucchini drop. These two recipes should use up 2 to 3 medium zucchini, so that's a start. First up, Daniel has cooked up some wheat berries to go with the veggies.
Basically, it's the whole wheat kernel. So when you put them out like that on a plate, they're going to be hard. They almost look like rice, like a brown rice. What you'll notice is when you cook them, and they take quite a while to cook, about 45 minutes to an hour, they're going to pop up, and they're going to be kind of like a soft popcorn kernel almost. If you want to give them a little taste, they're kind of crunchy. And as you chew them, the flavor kind of develops, and you get kind of the sweetness. All right, so we're over at the stove now, and I've got kind of a nice wide bottom pan, and we're going to start with the garlic. And I've got about a couple tablespoons of garlic. I love garlic, so. Okay, and you want to cook that until it's just a little bit brown, and it'll start to smell kind of toasty. And at that point, we're going to add the shallots. Okay, and the zucchini, which we've diced, and the nice carrots, which we've cut into rondelles, and about 3 or 4 scallions. Cook this until it just becomes tender, because we want to have a little bit of texture to our salad. I'm going to season these with some salt and pepper. And then another favorite Earth Eats ingredient is our lemon zest. Okay, and that's really all it takes. We don't need to cook it very long. I'm going to go back over, back into the bowl. To that amount, we're going to add about 3 cups of cooked wheat berries, about 1 cup of feta cheese, just roughly crumbled. And then we've got some cherry tomatoes. Okay, we're going to give that a toss. Okay, and you can see a very, very pretty salad. Let me give it a taste. Really a great combination of textures. You could also, instead of the feta, you could add tofu if you wanted to keep it vegan. We're going to do some baked egg and vegetable cups with tomato and pesto. Today you can see I've got some nice shiny black eggplant. I've got some beautiful red and green peppers, some nice young tender zucchini. Anything that you could kind of scoop out and fill, like if you're doing stuffed vegetables, you could use for this dish. What we're going to do is just cut them into cups. And so I've taken the peppers and cut them in half or into quarters. The eggplant I've cut into discs about, I would say, 1.5 inches thick, and then I've scooped them out with a spoon. The same with the zucchini. Then what I've done is I've sprinkled them with some olive oil and some salt and pepper, and then we've roasted those off. So we have some pre-made roasted vegetable cups. All right, what we're going to do now is we're going to crack some nice local eggs, an egg into each one, and they just kind of settle in there. And I'm going to sprinkle them with a little salt and a little pepper. And then I've got some homemade pico de gallo, which means the bite of a rooster. So it's chopped tomatoes, cilantro, onions, garlic. I put a little bit of olive oil, salt and pepper, and some jalapeno. So it should have that little bite. Okay, and then I'm going to top those with some Parmesan cheese, and we're going to toss those in a hot oven and bake them off until they're nice and brown. Okay, and here we go, right out of the oven. And you can see I also put a little drizzle of tomato juice in the bottom there to help keep them from sticking. Now we're going to plate them. And while these were baking, I put a pot on the stove, and I took all those, what I call the guts, the little scraps from the zucchini, peppers, and eggplant, and I diced those up, put them in a pot with some tomato juice and some onion and garlic, and brought that to a boil, and I made a quick little sauce. kind of chunky. We're just going to ladle that around. And we're just going to garnish it with some green. Got some fennel tops here. And those are our baked eggs with vegetable cups with a tomato and eggplant sauce.
The pictures that go with this recipe are especially cool. Avon Binder snaps our photos and we post them with the recipes on the website. Do a keyword search for zucchini and you'll see even more goodies, from chocolate zucchini cake to vegan zucchini scones. Go to eartheats.org. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Elizabeth Rue, enrolled agent and owner of Personal Financial Services, providing tax preparation for individuals and businesses, located on the Beeline Trail. More information at personalfinancialservices.net. Need more coffee roasters? A woman-owned coffee bar and roastery dedicated to roasting organic, direct trade, and fair trade coffee from small-scale farmers around the world. On the east side of Bloomington, corner of Pete Ellis and Longview, needmoreroasters.com. And Charles Schwab & Company Incorporated, with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington, independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. During next week's solar eclipse, while many spectators across the country will turn their eyes upward to see the moon pass in front of the sun, many Midwest scientists will turn their eyes and cameras to the plants and animals here on the ground. Arvis Public Media's Christopher Husted reports.
First things first, a total eclipse occurs when the moon slides across the sun, blocking it completely. A different part of the Earth experiences a total eclipse about once a year. So says Angela Speck, director of astronomy at the University of Missouri-Columbia.
The place that gets to see that total eclipse is only about 0.1% of the surface of the Earth. So even though they happen every year, in a given location, they're very rare.
In the U.S., a 70-mile-wide ribbon from Oregon to South Carolina, called the Path of Totality, will experience the total eclipse. Large swaths of farmland in the Great Plains and Midwest will see darkness for 2.5 minutes and experience a temperature drop of about 10 degrees in the middle of the day. Will animal and plant behavior change? That's the question many scientists are considering, Speck says.
It's never really been studied systematically. And so we have ideas about, is this an illumination thing? You know, the amount of light they're receiving goes down. Is that what it is? Is it a temperature effect? Is it all of that?
Tim Reinbaut wants to find out. He's the director of field operations at the South Farm Research Center in Columbia, Missouri. Today, he's driving across the farm to check where researchers will set up cameras to document corn, soybeans, and livestock.
So this is where our live stream is going to take place, right out here.
Pulling out a corn stalk in a pot, Reinbaut says he's eager to see how drought-stressed corn and soybean plants react to the change in light and temperature during the eclipse. Typically, when these plants are coping with limited water, they twist up their leaves during the day to prevent loss of moisture. Then, during the night, they unfold to breathe in carbon dioxide.
During the middle of the day, during the middle of all this, will it unfold itself and then fold itself right back up in response to the eclipse? So I don't know if it's going to happen or not. Maybe it's too quick. You know, whether they work or not, we're going to learn something.
It's true, a lot of research is done in labs to see how plants react to different conditions, including research on drought-stressed plants. But Reinbaut says the eclipse is so unique that it would be a challenge to recreate those exact conditions in a greenhouse or pasture.
And you just can't quite mimic that. Also, we've got the full spectrum with the sun. All the shades, red lights, green lights, blues. It's hard to get that artificially.
For farmers, the rows of corn and soybeans striping through the Midwest will only briefly dip in photosynthesis. University of Missouri plant biologist Manny Liskum says any light or temperature changes that hit the crops during the eclipse will come out as a wash during harvest. No bushels lost.
And the reason for that is that plants normally are adapting to local environments because they're fixed in the soil, they're sessile. They can't escape their environment. So they undergo huge changes in their light environment during the course of a single day.
Animals, however, are not fixed in the soil. At the South Farm Research Center, Reinbaut will have the cameras pointed at horses.
But either they're going to get really frisky or they're going to want food. Who knows?
And at chickens in a coop.
I think when it gets even thunderstorms, they'll kind of go in. So I think they'll be real reactive to it. But then again, it's cool. They may say, you know, maybe I need to stay out here and eat some more. I don't know.
University of Missouri biology professor Candy Galen is even putting out microphones near beehives and in a pumpkin patch to record buzzing activity.
I don't really know. I don't think it is really known. The cues that bees use or don't use when they're foraging that tell them to, you know, jump ship and go back to their hives or stay put.
Researchers are also working with cattle ranchers and even fishermen to monitor fish activity throughout the eclipse, Reinbot says. He calls it
observational learning. What they observe, let us know. And you get enough folks observing the same thing, that's a replicated trial.
Ultimately, Reinbot says, sure, we might not learn a groundbreaking fact during these eclipse studies that can be applied immediately to science. But maybe something will be learned that researchers can use down the line in a breakthrough to improve food production. Christopher Husted, Harvest Public Media.
Visit harvestpublicmedia.org for more stories from this reporter collective. John Kay came into the Earth Eats studios a couple years ago with a basket. It was his great-great-grandmother's oak rod basket. When his grandmother gave him the basket, she also gave him a picture of his great-great-grandmother using it. The photo probably dates to around 1919. You can't tell if she's feeding the chickens or collecting the eggs, but the basket is clearly a tool for her farm work in Heltonville, Indiana.
This one is an oval-shaped basket. Looks kind of like a willow basket, but it's made with these long white oak rods, which the makers would have pulled through these dies to kind of render the splits of white oak into a round form. And it made for a very strong, sturdy basket. And then it's got a single handle over the top that they would have wrapped, or they did wrap, with white oak all the way around it to make it kind of smooth and stronger. The ones that were intended for heavier use, they would have twisted as well as wrapped around them to make them extra strong and sturdy.
Kay is the director of Traditional Arts Indiana. He's researched the history of these baskets in Brown County. He doesn't know the origins of his family's basket, but his great-great-grandmother probably bought it from someone she knew who made it by hand.
There were men, almost exclusively men, that made these baskets in this region, and they were listed in census records as basket makers. So where all their neighbors were farmers, and they were probably farmers, day laborers as well, they considered themselves basket makers.
Kay tracks oak rod baskets back to three families. Henry Hovis was the man who brought the tradition to Brown County in 1848. George Bohall taught his five sons how to make baskets. The family was so famous, oak rod baskets are often called Bohall baskets. A bit later on, Rube Morgan and his family got into basketry. These were sold to hardware stores, to their neighbors.
And how do we find out about how these baskets were used? We can see them in museums. We can see them in thrift shops and those sort of things, but we don't understand that much about it. So what I've done is I've kind of combed through historic photographs and found images of the Ping family gathering hickory nuts near their home. You can see the shagbark hickory trees all around them. And you see two of these oak rod baskets on the forest floor there as they're sitting around gathering up the hickory nuts. You can see images of near Stonehead of a big long table with the family all standing behind it, the food all spread out on the table. And underneath the table, nicely tucked away, are a few of these oak rod baskets. They would have carried these baskets full of food to important family gatherings when they went. So these would have been just an ever-present, constant part of everyday life for a lot of folks in this region.
That was in the 1920s and 30s. Then big city tourists visited Brown County, and they wanted these baskets as souvenirs. Demand went up, but then after World War II,
there were a lot fewer of these type of baskets and more fancy baskets that were being brought up from Kentucky and Tennessee were being made primarily by women that with fancy plated handles and decorative rims for them. Instead of the work baskets that the locals used and made.
And in terms of using the baskets for farm work, they just didn't make sense anymore. By the 50s and 60s, There were plastic buckets and cardboard boxes and canvas bags. Nowadays, we've sort of come full circle. It's charming to carry a basket to the farmer's market. Knitters and crafters will use baskets like these for their materials.
There are people all over this region now that are collecting these oak rod baskets. They've become very kind of highly desirable. Now in an antique mall, I can still find them for $15 or $20, you know. But if someone knows what they are, they're selling for $100 or $300 for a big laundry basket or something like that. But I always don't think about the money part of it. I think about the labor part of it. And I think about, you know, the fact that we have this tradition here in Indiana and we let it go. But we're not alone. There was about 6 or 7 states that had small pockets where oak rod baskets were made. And as far as I can tell, I've asked around, I think it's pretty much gone everywhere.
It's hard to know when the craft really stopped. He's described it as having just sort of faded away. One of the last basket makers he tracked down was Bruce Hovis, Henry's grandson. He made baskets through the 1980s, and so did a grandson of George Bohall. But that was the generation that didn't pass on the skill to their kids. Kay speculates it was because the lure of better money doing less strenuous work in the city was more enticing. John Kay did manage to track down another descendant of the Brown County basket makers.
I actually went to talk with Claude Morgan, Rube Morgan's son, who actually made one basket when he was a kid. He's probably the last of the makers, you might say, even though he says he's not a basket maker. He made one.
Kay asked to see the place where Rube Morgan did his work back in the turn of the century.
He goes, oh, our family doesn't own that property anymore.
Kay insisted because he knew Morgan used to write his patterns on the wall where he worked.
And he goes, what? I don't know what you're talking about. And he goes, let's go see if we can find it. And we went to the barn. Now, this guy died in 1981. And went to the barn where he used to work, asked the people who own the property now. And I go in there, and on his wall, on the door jamb, and on posts of the walls of his barn, he has all the materials written out, what lengths, how many rods, what length of the rods they needed to be, what you start with pattern for each one of his baskets, you know, the recipes, you might say, right there on the wall of the barn.
Jackpot. He snapped pictures so he could analyze Morgan's process and write up his recipes. The current owners say Kay got there just in time. They'd been thinking about putting a fresh coat of paint on that wall. John Kay is a professor of practice at Indiana University. He's also the director of Traditional Arts Indiana. See a picture of him with his great-great-grandmother's oak rod basket at eartheats.org. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Needmore Coffee Roasters, a woman-owned coffee bar and roastery dedicated to roasting organic, direct trade, and fair trade coffee from small-scale farmers around the world. On the east side of Bloomington, corner of Pete Ellis and Longview, needmoreroasters.com. Charles Schwab & Company Incorporated, with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington, independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. And Elizabeth Rue, enrolled agent and owner of Personal Financial Services, providing tax preparation for individuals and businesses. Located on the Beeline Trail, more information at personalfinancialservices.net. For Earth Eats Today, I'm Annie Corrigan. Thanks for listening.